All right, Alexander. So Joe Biden is now in Brussels, and he is meeting with NATO officials. He participated in an EU US summit as well, and it seems like he's the I guess if he was the Beatles, if the EU were the Beatles, Joe Biden would be the fifth member of the Beatles, wouldn't he? It seems like he's part of the EU, even though last time I checked, the US is not part of the EU. Anyway, NATO, the EU, I guess it's all the same. And Biden is in Brussels discussing all kinds of things, most notably Russia and China. So, what's going on in Brussels?
Well, let's first start with the EU because this appears to be extraordinary, but in fact, it's standard. If you go back in time to an article I did for the Duran, around, which is on the Duran site, when which I did at the time of the Brexit referendum, just before it, in fact, I pointed out there that in fact the US is actively involved in the work of the EU, and that every so often US ambassadors and officials attend meetings of CAREPA, which is a group of committees, a committee which brings together the ambassadors of EU member states. Now that's important because, in fact, most of the decisions the EU makes, which get ratified, which get stamped, and which go into EU law, are not made by the EU Council, as many people think, or the Council of Ministers. They are made at CAREPA, which is attended, as I said, by the US. So though the US has not been a member, is not officially a member of the EU, it's a kind of shadow partner and has been for a very long time. It's not quite clear when this became institutionalized, but it goes all the way back certainly to Obama's years. But all right, let's put all that aside. That's the procedure technicalities. This was a meeting, NATO, EU meetings coming directly after the G7. It was an attempt basically to persuade the world that the United States, as Joe Biden says, is back, that the United States now has a strong, purposeful president who is prepared to consolidate the West and rebuild the Transatlantic Alliance. And it was also an attempt to persuade everybody that all of these institutions that make up the West, the G7, the NATO, the EU, are all working with clockwork efficiency and that everything is as good as always. The problem is, and this is actually very obvious when you drill through all the verbiage and all the documents that came out, that none of that is true. No part of this is, in fact, actually the case. You have a president who loses his train of thought in the middle of a press conference and can't get through a press conference without appearing, well, frankly, all over the place. So he mixes up Libya with Syria, as we've discussed. He talks about how the US might extradite people to Russia, which is actually constitutionally impossible. He makes one sort of bizarre blunder after another. We have a G7 summit meeting, which is overshadowed by a row between the British and the Europeans, which is, by the way, on an important subject for the British at least, and perhaps also for the Europeans, but which doesn't give any good impressions about the G7 meeting. The EU is a dysfunctional mess and has been for a very long time. It's now facing a major potential crisis in France if Marine Le Pen wins the presidential election there next year, which is looking increasingly possible. There's uncertainty in Italy. There's instability in Spain, which we're going to be turning to recently. There's a very difficult transition underway in Germany with Merkel about to leave. And of course, on top of everything else, the EU economy is a mess also. And then last but not least, we have NATO, this great military alliance, which everybody talks about as being this imposing military force. It's becoming increasingly clear that the US wants to redirect it away from its focus on Europe so that it can take on China. And for the first time, NATO talks about China in its final communique, though in a way that frankly is bizarre because China is not part of the European system, the North Atlantic system, which is what NATO is supposed to be all about. But again, when you drill down through this long compendious communique that NATO has produced, the thing that comes across very obviously, very strikingly, is that it's all aspirations, all declarations, all criticisms of other countries, China, Russia, which comes in for an enormous amount of criticism. But on the key issue, which the US has been pushing for so long, which Donald Trump was trying to make central to the relationship between the United States and NATO, which is getting the NATO countries to actually increase their defence spending, well, that's all fallen by the wayside. So it's a military alliance which is also looking increasingly tatty and creaky. So it's all show. It's a show of strength without any strength. It's every single part of this stool, the US leadership, the presidency, the G7, the EU and NATO, they all look at the moment like hollow things. And I think this is going to accelerate. The Chinese are already circulating cartoons, really, really, I thought, actually unpleasant cartoons, ridiculing what's going on in Europe and especially the G7 summit. And I have to say, people around the world who look to these events and expect leadership or some, that's, you know, sign of strength, what they are going to be seeing here is growing symptoms of decay. Leaders who've lost their way and who are not even really leaders anymore and who are repeating themselves. I mean, the things they said about Russia, they've been saying for the last 7 years. There's nothing new.
Okay, so let's stay on spending real quick. And I've got a chart here from Statista, and it has the spending of NATO. There's two countries that spent over 3% of their GDP on military spending. Estimated military spending of NATO countries and the shared GDP in 2021. I'm putting the chart up so people can see it. NATO defense expenditures. The one country that spends 3.52% of its GDP on defense is, of course, the United States. It's over $811 billion. It's just a massive amount. And after that, there's only one other country that spends over 3% of its GDP and on military, and that is Greece, which spends 3.82%, actually the most. After that, Alexander, there's very few countries that spend over 2%. UK, France, just barely. Poland, just barely. Romania, just barely. Croatia, okay, 2.79%. Lithuania, just barely. Estonia, Latvia, a little over. Every other country after that is literally 1%. Some are even under 1%. I mean, it's just crazy. Without the U.S., NATO is useless. I mean, absolutely useless. This is not really a military alliance, is it?
No.
That's why they're looking for another enemy in China or an enemy anywhere, because this is a slush fund. True. I mean, it's a slush fund.
It's a slush fund. It's a complete slush fund. And this was, by the way, brutally exposed during the crisis in Ukraine this April, because the Russians deployed 75,000 men, some say, 100,000 men, others say, 200,000 men, others say still, apparently two army groups and an airborne contingent, and they did it within 10 days. NATO hasn't got those numbers. It can't put all those troops together. There's about 26,000 US troops in NATO. The British military can perhaps field 20,000 men if it's really push comes to shove, but that's actually getting them from pretty much everywhere else. France, perhaps a little more, a little less. They are actually, in military terms, they are zero. They're zilch. The real military power in the West is the United States. It's got huge nuclear capabilities, a powerful air force, a very, very powerful navy, but it is bearing all the burden of military spending ultimately falls on the United States. But it's very useful for the Europeans to be able to come along, have these meetings with the American president, get the impression that, you know, they're being taken seriously, that they're important. They can issue all these great, grandiose statements about Russia, about China. They can make them feel important. And at the same time, they get all kinds of funds distributed from American taxpayers, overwhelmingly, which circulate around NATO, are used to buy NATO weapons, well, predominantly American weapons, F-16 fighters in the case, say, of Poland or Romania or whatever, and, of course, makes some people very wealthy. But as a military alliance, you are absolutely right. It is hollow. It's nothing. It has as much credibility as a dried twig, which you can snap with the greatest of ease. That's the truth of it. Compare that with the other side, and I think now we have to start talking increasingly about the other side, about what the Chinese and the Russians are doing, and you get a completely different picture. There you see real militaries and growing militaries, and militaries that get ever stronger. And the thing is, and this is the thing which Donald Trump, we have to bring him up again, identified. He understood. The Europeans want to keep it this way. They don't want to ramp up their own defence spending to match their commitments. Because if they do, the United States can quite validly say there's less need to protect these people because they're perfectly capable of defending themselves. So at that point, US troops could leave. And the Europeans could take care of themselves. The Europeans don't want to increase defence spending. They want to free ride on the Americans. Because from their point of view, it's a wonderful racket. That's all it is.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Greece, 3.82%. Well, and I'm sure that 3.82% is all being spent so that they can protect, Greece can protect itself from their other NATO partner, which is Turkey. That's how silly this all is. It's absolutely crazy. If they just took 1% of that 3.82%, 1%, we could probably, I don't know, maybe pay down some debt. God knows what we could do with that 1%. I mean,
we could sort out the internet in Athens. That would be a tremendous force multiplier, which would change the Greek economy overnight. That's what we could do with that 1%. But of course, we're not going to.
No, we're not. It's a racket. It's a racket. So Trump had these jokers figured out. He had these guys all figured out. And now you have Biden, Macron at the G7 said that it's great to have a U.S. president who's in the club. He just came out and just said it. It's great to have a president that is in the club. So what is Biden doing there? I mean, is this really a meaningful meeting, or is this just all for show? Because at the end of the day, like we said, it's a slush fund. When everyone, this meeting adjourns and everyone goes their way and Biden goes to Geneva to meet with Putin, the real budgets are going to be decided. The real spending is going to be decided. I'm sure NATO's a massive bureaucracy as well. So you've probably got tens of thousands of salaries, really good salaries that need to be paid. You got weapons that need to be bought. You got kickbacks that need to be paid. And nothing's going to really change. But it seems that this alliance is decaying and other militaries are actually building militaries with a purpose, with a focus and a purpose. NATO is just bleeding countries' GDP dry.
Absolutely, that's exactly what it's doing. Now, as I said, what has been achieved by this tour? Actually, it's achieved the opposite of what I think it was intended to do. Firstly, I think that there are some people in the United States who do have some belief or conviction that they can somehow rally the Europeans against China. But we had an incredibly tepid statement from the G7 about China, because the Europeans are so heavily invested in maintaining good relations with China from a financial point of view, I want to stress. And of course, the NATO communique on China is one sentence. I mean, the Chinese have taken offence against it, but it's so thin. Because ultimately, again, the Europeans don't care about China. They don't really worry about China. It's far away, and it's the country where you can buy all sorts of good things and make lots of money and do all kinds of trade with. They don't see it as a competitor and a rival in the way that the US does, because as far as they're concerned, it's not really a competitor and a rival. Perhaps they're being misguided in thinking that way, but that is how they think. So the Americans, I think, hoped that they would be able to get NATO, the Europeans, on side against China. That hasn't really happened. So in all other respects, it's just an empty show, because nothing has been achieved. And when Macron comes along and when he says it's great to have a president who's a member of the club, well, that tells you everything, because, of course, the club ultimately is a European club. And it means that the Americans are now once again paid up members. It's that way round, actually.
Yeah, no more America first. Biden was just sitting there nodding as well, instead of, maybe saying, hey, we spend like 80% of all the NATO budget. So I don't think we're a member of the club. I think we kind of lead the club. But no, he didn't say that.
That's actually the valid point, because, of course, the US could say, well, we're paying for everything. We have our concerns about China. You don't back us on China. You know, we're prepared to pull out because you're not serving any useful purpose to us. A strong president might have said that. Donald Trump might have cut round to saying that. We now know that in the last weeks of his presidency, he wanted to pull all US troops out of Germany. But Biden never will. So the result is that, in effect, what he's doing is he's giving the Europeans a blank check. He's giving them everything they want, because from their point of view, he's just a cipher to keep this nice show, which they're so happy with, on the road.
All right, Alexander, let's talk about the one hot zone in Europe where we may see some action between NATO and one of their so-called enemies, in this case, Russia, and that is Ukraine. Zelensky has come out with statements this week where he says that he was promised entry into NATO. He's adamant about it. He says, I was promised entry into NATO. Joe Biden, even in his cognitive decline, has recognized the danger of allowing Ukraine into NATO, and he has watered down Zelensky's statements. He has tried to walk those back, and he says, no, we never promised you such a thing. And I'm paraphrasing, but what if Zelensky and Ukraine are admitted into NATO, and what if you do get some sort of Russia-NATO conflict? What happens in that scenario?
Right. Ukraine is defeated. Russia wins. NATO is utterly humiliated and perhaps disintegrates, which is why it's not going to happen.
Who is NATO, though, in this fighting? Who would you say would actually back Ukraine's entry to NATO? Like, what countries in Europe outside? Which ones do you think would throw their hat in the ring, say?
Right. The Baltic states, Poland, Romania, Britain. And of course, Erdogan has also said that he supports it, though I'm not sure that he actually would if push came to shove. But those are the countries that would back that. But there would be a war. I mean, that is almost a given in that kind of situation. NATO would be treaty bound to come to Ukraine's rescue. In practice, it wouldn't. It is inconceivable. It's absolutely inconceivable that countries like Germany or France, or indeed even the United States, would be prepared to go to war against Russia to defend Ukraine. And by the time anyway that they got their troops there, they would be overwhelmed by the Russian army. So Ukraine would be destroyed. NATO would and the NATO guarantee, Article 5, would be exposed as a dead letter, at which point it's very difficult to see how NATO could survive. And I strongly suspect that's the reason why it's not going to happen, because ultimately the NATO leadership, certainly the US, knows that this NATO is, in military terms, a bluff. And their absolute terror must always be that bluff may one day be called. To give an example, it's the same with the Baltic states. They know perfectly well that if there was a Russian attack on the Baltic states, of which, by the way, the Russians have no interest in doing, they have no great feelings about the Baltic states. But if there was, they know perfectly well that the Baltic states are undefendable and would be rapidly overrun, and NATO would be exposed as the hollow shell that it really is. And one of the reasons why they are so sensitive about the Baltic states is precisely for that reason. A NATO official actually said that the Baltic states are Russia's hostage. They are the hostage that Russia has over NATO. But with Ukraine, which the Russians do feel about, it would be another matter. As I said, we could end up with a war and NATO would be exposed as the Wizard of Oz alliance that it really is. You know, all very impressive and fire and thunder on the outside, in the end and in reality, a little old man twiddling away at the levers, telling us not to look at the man behind the curtain. So that they don't want that to happen. And that's why I predict that Ukraine will never join NATO.
What's behind Zelensky's statements then?
Desperation. He was induced, and I think it's now becoming increasingly clear that this was a plot, this is a plan. He was persuaded to deploy large numbers of Ukrainian troops to the contact line, thinking that if he threatened a war in eastern Ukraine, the Russians would come round and agree to make concessions because they would be frightened by the prospect of sanctions if they intervened. Where it became clear that the Russians were fully prepared to intervene and were not prepared and were not afraid of sanctions. NATO called on him to back down, which he was obliged to do. That has left him dangerously exposed. I've been reading reports about the state of the Ukrainian military on the contact line. It is still there because Zelensky can't withdraw it, because if he did withdraw it, he would find himself in very, very severe difficulties with the hardliners in Kiev. So it is still there and it is disintegrating. I've been reading that there's now increasing amount of desertion. A lot of the troops are becoming very disaffected and demoralised, which is what always happens when you leave large numbers of men in the field with nothing essentially to do. So he's becoming desperate. He made this big play in the spring. It's not worked out for him well at all. He's becoming increasingly nervous that the Russians and the Americans are going to talk about Ukraine in Geneva, and that he's not been consulted about it in advance. And that makes him extremely worried. He's complained about it. He's complained about it bitterly. He sees Nord Stream 2 on the verge of completion. And he's also aware that Ukraine's economy is steadily spiraling downward, and with it, his poll ratings. So he is becoming increasingly desperate. He is inventing promises for Ukraine to join NATO, which he thinks will win him some support in Ukraine itself, but in, which instead are repeatedly exposing him as a fantasist and even a liar.
Okay, let's talk about one final hot area, perhaps a hot area, the Balkans and Serbia. What about that area with regards to NATO? Do you see anything going on there?
I'm going to make a guess, actually. I think the ultimate crisis for NATO is not going to come in Ukraine, because though they are absolutely, they understand too well that if they got themselves into a confrontation with Russia in Ukraine, it would be a disaster for them. And I think they will always back off, therefore giving NATO membership to Ukraine. But of course, they've given NATO membership to all sorts of countries in the Balkans, which commits them to defending those countries. If there is a major crisis in the Balkans, which I think there eventually will be, I've said this many times, it is only a question of time before there is a crisis in the Balkans. At that point, again, NATO will be exposed as a bluff, because back in 1999, they could bomb Yugoslavia and they could do so not knowing that there was no real danger of the situation escalating, because Russia was in a state of chaos and Boris Yeltsin was president. Today, Russia is resurgent. Its military is very powerful. Vladimir Putin is the president. The people who look set one day to take over from him are even more hardline than they are, than he is. And of course, behind Russia, there is China, which in 1999 was only about the size in economic terms of Italy, but which now today rivals the United States itself. So they could face a crisis in the Balkans. It's much more likely that they would face a crisis in the Balkans, and one which they wouldn't know how to extricate themselves from, and which would expose again NATO as the bluff that it really is. The reason I think it's more likely to happen in the Balkans is because they don't give much attention to the Balkans. They don't really think about it very much. They don't think about the problems of Serbia. They don't think about the problems of Greece. They don't think about the problems of Kosovo or of Bosnia. They don't want to think about these things. They think that they are in control of the situation there, when in reality they are not. So it's quite possible that the crisis could begin in the Balkans, and that's where the whole thing could start to fall apart.
Right. So, I mean, you have Kosovo, but essentially it is just a NATO base. I mean, that's all it is. It's just one large NATO base, and it's just smack sitting there in the middle of the Balkans. And you're presenting the scenario, and we're talking about a scenario where there's conflict. What if the reverse happens and Serbia decides to join NATO?
Well,
what does that mean for Russia? Because the one scenario is saying, you know, there would be conflict in the Balkans, and essentially you're going to have, you know, NATO aligning against certain other countries, and maybe Russia intervenes. I don't know. Do they intervene? You said during the live stream that they don't consider Serbia is a brotherly friend, but it's not an ally. Yes. It's not a defined ally. Yes. But then you have this other scenario, which is, what does it mean for a country like Russia in the case that, for some strange reason, I think it would be political suicide, but a Serbian president says, you know what, I don't care, we're going into NATO and the EU. Yes. We're going full in.
Yeah. Yes. If that happens, the Russians will be deeply upset. They'll feel again that they've lost an important ally, but they'll accept it. Serbia is not an existential issue. They will not go to war to prevent Serbia joining NATO, if that's what the Serbian government decides to do. It is not for them an existential issue in the way that Ukraine is. I mean, one must never forget that for Russians, cities like Odessa, Kharkov and the rest, they conceive of them principally and ultimately as Russian cities. And they conceive of the people who live in those cities as Russians. And I suspect that if you scratch below the surface, you'll find that many of the people who live in those cities, most of them, in fact, I suspect the overwhelming majority of them, think in the same way. So, you know, it was the Russian Empire that created these cities, Odessa, Kharkov, Nikolaev, Kherson, and Tiraspol and the rest. It was, you know, they are entirely Russian creations, and the people who live there speak Russian and belong to the Russian cultural sphere. So for the Russians, Ukraine is important. It is part of what used to be their country, and it is right smack in the middle of their territory, their historic territory. Serbia is a country they have very strong feelings towards. They see it as fraternal, a Slav country in the Balkans, which they have fought wars for and which has fought wars alongside them. But it is not an existential issue for them. So, you know, if Serbia were to join NATO, you'd see Russian influence in the Balkans collapse. I mean, that would be an inevitable byproduct of that. The Russians would be very upset, very humiliated even, but they would not fight to prevent it. If Ukraine looked like it was going to join NATO, then the Russians would fight. I mean, that is, from their point of view, an absolutely fundamental red line, and that is a difference. I don't think it's going to happen, by the way, or at least if it does happen, it could only happen with some kind of regime change stroke color revolution scenario being enacted in Belgrade, which is by no means impossible, incidentally. But if that did happen, if Serbia were to go through a color revolution scenario and a new regime were to be set up in Serbia that were to join NATO, that actually would be a very, very unstable situation. And that regime might quickly fall, in which case we could have that very scenario that we're talking about, in which the Balkans explodes, NATO finds itself with all kinds of commitments it cannot really honour, because Serbia at that point would have Russia at its back, and then the whole NATO thing unravels. The whole ramshackle structure falls apart. By the way, since you brought up the subject of the Balkans and Serbia, the Chinese, who were very annoyed by and very contemptuous of all of these actions in Europe, the G7 summit, the NATO summit, the EU summit, all that, they've actually pointedly reminded everyone. There's actually a Chinese foreign ministry statement that pointedly reminded everyone that China has an interest in the Balkans and that the Chinese embassy in Belgrade was bombed by NATO in 1999. And they said that they have not forgotten that. It was a statement that was issued in Beijing yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just game playing it out. And, you know, yeah, if you look absolutely at the world today, I can't really see any benefit to joining NATO whatsoever. I mean, there really is no benefit, not on a military level and definitely not on a financial level. That's for damn sure.
Well, not of course for a country. No country or nation does well from joining these institutions or entities. I was talking not so long ago to a young woman from Slovenia, which used to be the most pro-European part of Yugoslavia, and she was telling me how decayed the situation in Slovenia has become, and how Slovenia now basically just exists. It doesn't even really function. It's all its vibrancy and life, which it used to have gone, and how disillusioned people are. The nations, the countries may decay, but of course there are lots of individuals, and we must always talk about individuals, who do very well out of this. They become the members of that club, which Macron was talking about. They get invited to all the nice meetings and they get all the payoffs and kickbacks that go with that. And that community of people in percentage terms may be very small, but in terms of their influence, it is very great.
All right, we'll leave it there. Guys, go to the Durant Shop, 10% off. Use the code REALNEWS. Take care. No.